Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 27, 2018. This is the Week 8 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is the second class on the Three Marks of Existence. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
We're, as I said earlier, we're in the eighth week of our 12-week or so Dhamma study based on the Truth of Happiness book. We are discussing the three marks of existence this week and last week, and we'll get into dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates next week. But I think you'll see as we go through these 4 weeks or so how these are all describing in different ways the nature and the origination of suffering, and also it points directly to how we can bring this to cessation by awakening, by gaining full human maturity. The Buddha's words on impermanence, just once again, the perceiving of impermanence, developed and frequently practiced, removes all sensual passion, removes all passion for material existence, removes all passion for becoming, removes all ignorance, removes and abolishes all conceit of I am. So I would say that the perceiving of impermanence is pretty important according to the Buddha. And you remember when Kandana first heard the Four Noble, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he declared that all conditioned things that arise, all impermanent things that arise, are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, you are now awakened, you are now Anakandana. Because the Buddha understood that Kandana had penetrated to the deepest level the nature of the three marks of existence, the impermanence, all conditioned things that arise, the not-self-characteristic, are subject to cessation, meaning that our thoughts and our perceptions about ourselves and the world around us are constantly changing. And they change in direct relationship to what we're holding in mind, to the level of our mindfulness. And if the level of our mindfulness is framed by the Eightfold Path, then no dukkha, no disappointing experiences will be developed. And so we start unraveling these three linked characteristics, don't we? And we start separating our contributions to suffering through our understanding of what constitutes a self and the impermanent nature that we're in. The Buddha continues directly after that last quote. Just as in the autumn, a farmer plowing with a large plow cuts through all the spreading rootlets as he plows, in the same way, my dear friends, the perceiving of impermanence developed and frequently practiced removes all sensual passion, removes and abolishes all conceit of I am. So the metaphor there is that it is clinging to wrong views of self that spreads the roots of ignorance throughout our lives. And as we start developing the Dhamma, we're developing the real ability, not just the metaphorical ability, to cut those roots off, to cut our clinging off at the roots. At the roots is another metaphor for at their source, meaning at our thinking. And so, as you can see, I'm emphasizing the importance of thinking and thinking correctly, meaning right views. But also, in order to overcome, I was wondering how I was going to phrase this. I'm kind of eager to see how I exactly would do it, so here it comes. In order to overcome the nature of impermanence, we have to understand it. And if we're going to understand anything, we have to be in the midst of it. In order for us to understand impermanence, we have to be in the midst of it, meaning we have to put ourselves in it. We have to accept where we are. You know, I said often that if we want to get to Chicago and we're in New York, but we believe we're in Los Angeles, we can't get there. It's impossible. Think about that for a moment. It's just, you got to know where you are to get to anywhere of any value. We have to understand that we're in an impermanent environment if we're going to understand our interaction within that environment. And that's the whole point of developing a well-concentrated mind and the framework of the Eightfold Path, to put us in our place, to put us here where our life is occurring. To start uniting, and this is something that's not often talked about in the Buddha's Dhamma, to start uniting the mind and the body where the mind and the body are actually present. And that's the only real importance, the uniting body and mind. We have to be here. If we're going to live our life, we have to be within our life, don't we? If we're going to awaken, we have to be in the midst of delusion. We have to be willing to look at it and be a part of it, at least momentarily, so that we can recognize that we need to make a step from here to there. We have to know where our feet are. Is that clear? So that last phrase, just as in the autumn a farmer plowing with a large plow cuts through all the spreading rootlets, cuts through all the clinging to wrong views, it is understanding that cuts through the roots of ignorance. And it really is just that simple. That's why the Buddha is using this metaphor here. Is that clear to everyone? Is everybody more or less understanding that the problem is wrong views within this environment of impermanence?
Yes.
And that those wrong... You can't answer on this one. And that those wrong views arise from a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self? Well, now you can answer. More... Yeah. Does everybody get that? So the Eightfold Path begins and ends with right view. So again, we talked about this when we first started getting into these 3 weeks, 4 weeks on the Eightfold Path. That the beginning of right view is accepting that right now I don't know everything. There's aspects of my view that are rooted in wrong view. That's putting yourself in your place. That's just accepting where you are. That's the beginning of right view. Just knowing that there's something else to be done. So I want to read the Dhammadina Sutta and just comment on that briefly, because it just relates so well. There's a few reasons why I like this sutta so much. One is there's always been a misunderstanding of the Buddha's relationship with women in the early Sangha, in the first Sangha. And there's still today information put out that the Buddha was vehemently against having women at any time being part of the Sangha. And that's just not true. The Buddha's concern at the time were related to the views about women in northern India at the time. And he was concerned that if he accepted them in the Sangha, which is giving them positions of power, especially in northern India at the time, that they would simply be murdered. And that was his real concern. It was simply for their safety. And after some discussions with his wife and the mother of his child and his aunt and a few other people, he finally relented and let the nuns into the Sangha. And throughout the suttas, you'll hear important teachings that were given by senior nuns. So they weren't just accepted into the Sangha. They were given every opportunity to awaken, and once awakened, they became teachers. The reason why I'm saying that last is even in much of modern Buddhism, this certainly isn't true in all sects, even the schools that allow women to come in and take novice vows will make it very difficult for them to achieve a full status in the Sangha. And even the Theravadins are guilty. One of the excuses is that the old rules stated that in order for a nun to receive the highest vows, there had to be a quorum of two other nuns present. And over time, the established nuns disappeared from northern India. And the then established Buddhist religion said, well, we can't install any more new nuns because there's no nuns here to be part of that ceremony. And that continues until today. I got off on a little bit of a tangent. But again, one of the reasons why I like this is this shows how important the nuns were in the Buddhist Sangha. And this isn't just the only sutta by a nun. Dhammadina was one of the most knowledgeable nuns of the Sangha. And this is another example of the importance of women in the early monastic tradition of the Buddhist Sangha. Visakha, the questioner in this sutta, is also well established in the Dhamma. Visakha is Dhammadina's ex-husband. Visakha is seeking clarity on anatta, the not-self characteristic, and how anatta continually establishes itself through clinging in all phenomena. Dhammadina, what is self-identification as described by the Buddha? Visakha, the Buddha teaches that self-identification is established by clinging to form, clinging to feeling, clinging to perceptions, clinging to fabrications, and by clinging to consciousness. Those are the five clinging aggregates, right? Everybody knows that? These five clinging aggregates are the self-identification taught by the Buddha. Again, the Buddha used the term, the five clinging aggregates, simply describe the personal experience of ongoing dukkha. Something has to have that experience. Something has to be wandering around, not knowing where it's going, and that vehicle, because of ignorance, that vehicle is the five clinging aggregates. You could say the five clinging aggregates are me. You could say the five clinging aggregates are karma. You could say that me in a deluded state, a non-awakened state, is karma. It's all of that. It's all part of anatta. It's all part of dukkha. It's all part of the three marks of existence. Visakha continues. Visakha continues. Your answer is very helpful. What then is the origination of self-identification to form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, indeed in every thought? In other words, what then is the origination of self-identification, period? What brings it up? Dhammadina's answer, it is craving, Visakha, that brings continual establishment of anatta, of the not-self characteristic. Craving born of clinging, accompanied by passion and by delight. Craving for sensual pleasure. Craving for continued establishment in this world and in other realms. I mean, she's not giving credence in other realms, just that we try to do it. We'll establish ourselves anywhere as long as we continue to maintain a view of ourself that in an ignorant mind is reasonable to do. Is that clear? Yes. Helen Jebby Howard. This is the origination of self-identification as taught by the Buddha. Visakha then asks, what then is the cessation of self-identification? How do we end this process? How do we recognize our own ignorance and bring it to cessation? The renunciation, the remainderless fading away of the very craving born of clinging that originates the continual establishment of anatta. So there's something that we have to do. We have to renounce this thing that we say is me. And before we renounce anything, before we actually take that step, we have to first understand what it is that we're renouncing, don't we? We have to put ourselves where we are.
I thought the sentence was prior to that was to renounce craving. Maybe I heard wrong.
I think you heard wrong. It's, well, the line that I just read, the renunciation and remainderless fading away of that very craving born of clinging. So there's the intention that the Buddha is describing. Right? Right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path?
The renunciation of craving, clinging, born of craving.
So yeah, right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging.
Right.
So that's where this comes into that, to the second noble truth.
Right.
Okay.
So, but then I thought you said it was the renunciation of anatta, which I know anatta is formed because of clinging and craving, and the aggregates together.
Well, again, maybe the word is a little too strong. Well, I don't think it's too strong. Maybe that's what's giving you trouble. Recognizing wrong views is the next step is then to let go of those views, to renounce the views.
Correct, but yes.
So I'm confused about what you're asking me then.
Because I thought you said then the next sentence after you said that it's a renunciation of clinging and craving, then I thought you said, so see, it's a renunciation of anatta.
Well, it is.
Because if we didn't,
anatta comes as a result of clinging and craving.
Yes, again, anatta and that.
Okay, I've got it.
You have it? I don't need to go. Okay. All right, I'm going to go back to that beginning of that. The renunciation and remainderless fading away of the very craving born of clinging that originates the continual establishment of anatta. Anatta just describes, is a word that says the views that you're holding of self are not accurate views. They're wrong views. Let go of the views. They don't accurately describe the self. That's the easiest and simplest and most direct way to understand anatta. That contradicts the way that anatta was originally used during the Buddha's time. And the only reason I'm saying that is if you've studied that and studied the Pali language, you'll realize that it does refer to something different. But the Buddha used common terms in very uncommon ways to simply make a point. Right? What then, dear lady, is the path or the practice leading to the cessation of self-identification that is taught by the Buddha? Excuse me. Visakha, it is precisely the noble eightfold path of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation that the Buddha teaches to develop the virtue, concentration, and wisdom required to abandon self-identification, to abandon eye-making, to abandon clinging. Is that a hand? Does everybody understand that? And again, this is another one of those sentences and phrases where the Buddha is pointing out the entire Dhamma in that one sentence. Does everybody get it? And he's emphasizing, again, or Dhammadina in this case, that is, it is the Eightfold Path that brings liberation from suffering. And again, the Buddha never taught any other path, and he didn't teach any advanced portions of the path. He never taught any embellishments to the path. In fact, he never taught mindfulness in any other way except to be mindful of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path, to hold those in mind. And here, Dhammadina is re-emphasizing this to Visakha. Visakha asks, is clinging the same as five clinging aggregates? This is a really interesting answer. Clinging is not the same as the five clinging aggregates, Visakha, nor is it separate. I'll explain that in a minute, maybe. It is the nature of the five clinging aggregates to cling. It is the function of the five clinging aggregates to cling. It is the nature of anatta to cling. It is the function of anatta to cling. So it's same and it's different. The Dhammadina is pointing out a coalescing point in time within the an impermanent nature. Is that clear what I just said, or is it way too...
No, it's the nature of it. It can't help but not.
There's elements in the physical world that come together to form different elements. We all mean a physical body is a good example of that. And so on a physical plane that is occurring in a constant, in a continual way, but also on a mental plane, as our thought constructs come together and fade away, just like all other impermanent phenomena. And in the coming together, in the decisions that we make to what we're going to cling to, is how we create our life. So if we can develop the understanding and the profound caution to know what to cling and what not to cling, will develop a life of lasting peace and happiness. In other words, do I want to cling myself to this, attach myself to this, if it's going to continue my deluded thinking and my ongoing disappointing experiences? Or am I going to recognize the I'm making in what I'm doing and simply cease, bring it to cessation, practice restraint? And so in that moment, within this impermanent environment, within this moment, I'm contributing toward my awakening by holding in mind proper use of mindfulness, the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. Is that clear?
John.
So this is how we start integrating something that is at first conceptual, meaning the Eightfold Path, and start integrating it in a deeply experiential way in our life. The Buddha's teaching, and I'm teaching here too, precisely how to integrate the Eightfold Path. There's nothing left up to faith or mysticism or merit or anything. If you want to integrate the Eightfold Path, these are the practices we develop in order to do that. And this is what you can expect. The Buddha's teaching us too. We can awaken more.
I thought you said it's teaching us what to cling to, what not to cling to, and what to cling to. And I would say I'm confused about what one should cling to.
The Dhamma.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the whole point of refined mindfulness. What are we going to hold in mind? You know, we can't, it's a good question. We can't continue to awaken with the same distracted, non-directed mind that got us here in the first place. Again, meditation deepens concentration, right? Starts to lessen distraction. The Eightfold Path provides a direction for that previously directionless mind, that mind that would attach itself to anything. Another word for distraction is non-direction. When we have the direction or the framework of the Eightfold Path, then we are focused towards what we are going to bring into and associate in our lives. Another word for clinging is association. If we're going to awaken, we have to associate with that which brings awakening, don't we? We can't associate with bowling on Thursday nights if we hope to awaken. We might develop a 300 game once in a while, but we'll have no chance of awakening, will we? But if we associate ourselves with what is likely to bring that, meaning the Eightfold Path, then we have a right to expect to awaken. Then what's left is simply to continue to engage in right effort that we're going to get into, we've got into last week, and we'll we'll continue to emphasize what that is over the next few weeks. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Yes, so, Isabel.
If I'm processing this correctly, so clinging to the Dhamma is for what? How I'm understanding it is for while we're developing the Eightfold, like this practice and the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
Because once we've reached that awakened state, it's not that we're not obviously, like, we're not, it's not in the context of what we've learned from the Dhamma, but we're at a point where we kind of don't, I don't know, it's just innate. It's
yep.
It is that condition where it's not necessarily, like, for me, I have to, in a way, cling to the Dhamma because I'm still developing this mindset, like,
yeah,
unconditioning or deconditioning the word.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh no, it's okay. I'm just removing that. I'm leaving that old conditioned mindset
yeah.
of dukkha of suffering
yeah.
and conditioning it to.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Thank you. You using the word. I'm going to say this because I'm sure I'm going to hear this. Using the word clinging as meaning clinging to the Dhamma. Clinging is just another word. And so clinging to something that's going to deliver us awakening is a good thing. It's a good aspect of clinging. It's a reasonable thing to do with our ability to cling ourselves to things, isn't it?
With right view, it's not.
With right view, clinging. It's framed properly. So another word for clinging is desire. Most of the time, desire gets us in trouble. But if it's skillful desire, and the word for that is chanda, chanda, it's that skillful desire that helps to direct our practice. So it's kind of clarifying. Thank you for bringing this up, Isabella. And more most
because I've never heard you use cling to the Dhamma. That's,
using,
I mean, but it's good. It's appropriate. It's just I'm not, I don't think has anybody else ever heard him say
no.
that in here.
No.
All right. That's why I caught it.
And so it's. Using it in that, and again, you're right, I probably never said it before, but it's an appropriate word, and it describes especially where we are in our Dhamma study right now. We should be clinging to the Dhamma, and we should be letting go of those things that aren't of the Dhamma, because that's how we will awaken. That's why the Buddha taught awakening. Another word, again, I'll say it again, but not, I don't mean that, I'm sorry, tired of saying it, you'll hear me say it a million times. Mindfulness, the proper use of the word mindfulness means to hold in mind. Another way of saying that is to cling to something. To cling to thoughts, to cling to concepts. The Buddha taught an eightfold mind so that we'll cling to the eightfold path, as opposed to clinging to those things that are outside of the eightfold path and will only contribute suffering. Is that clear? So we're getting into a little bit of a funny game with words here, but it's what we hold in mind, and holding, clinging, craving, desire, all that is all part of the same thing. Frank.
Kind of validated my wife's point to me. She said, aren't you clinging to the Dhamma or to meditation?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it's called right effort.
Yeah.
And she was like, I think it's clinging.
she's right.
And a shout out to her.
And you can tell her I said so. But what are we going to cling to? You know? Those are, I'm not saying this about your wife at all. But you've heard me say, Dawn, this is for you. You've heard me say in the past many times that we create very subtle and powerful strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. That phrase, that, well, isn't that clinging, is one of those powerful strategies that are very common in modern Buddhism. We'll use anything we can to say, well, an awakened human being's path can't be the right path. Let me do something else. Or to actually develop the path and do it, you know. So, all right, let me continue here with that. With the Kulavadala Sutta. Visakha asks, so how does self-identification develop? Dhammadina says, those uninstructed with regard to the Dhamma, run-of-the-mill people, with no regard for noble ones or those of integrity, are deluded. They believe that form to be the self or that the self possesses form. She's pointing out to the five clinging aggregates. She's saying that you believe that your physical self is all that, is who you are and all that you'll ever be. They believe it. This is how self-identification develops. They are further deluded to believe that their self-referential feelings are the self or that their perceptions of self defines the self. Now remember, these are all rooted in ignorance, so how could that? They can only define a view that is rooted in ignorance. They believe that their fabrications that further establish the self to be their self. So now you see that feedback loop, you know, the whatever that hamster cage that we get stuck in by these wrong views. And now it's our own views that are chasing us around the cage. They assume that their self-referential thoughts establish a self. Each of these five clinging aggregates are impermanent and arise from ignorance. They are, each of them, are anatta. They are not a self. So how does self-identification not develop? Dhammadina responds, those well instructed in regard to the Dhamma, with regard to the noble, for the noble ones and those with integrity, well disciplined in their practice, they do not believe the form to be the self. They do not believe that feelings establish or define a self, or that perception defines a self. They are free of mental fabrications and having no foundation for fabrications. You remember dependent origination states that from ignorance. The second factor in that is from mental fabrications arise from ignorance. That's how the whole chain of dependencies is set in motion. The Buddha's or Dhammadina's teaching here, once that ignorance is gone, there's no foundations for fabrications or for anything else that would follow. Clear? She's teaching directly how to undo clinging to wrong views. They do not assume that thoughts establish a self or that the self possesses thoughts. I mean, that's everything we do with it. Once we have a thought, we own it. We possess it because I've had the thought. They do not assume that consciousness is a self or that the self possesses a consciousness. There is no self attached to any of these five clinging aggregates. So again, the Dhammadina is explaining in a very practical and direct way how to recognize and abandon the makeup of five clinging aggregates, how to stop insisting that this is what we are, and the confusion and deluded thinking that follows from that. I'm going to skip forward a little bit. So now Visakha asked Dhammadina if the Eightfold Path is fabricated or unfabricated, and Dhammadina replies that the Eightfold Path is fabricated. The Eightfold Path is fabricated, these are my words, arising from form, feelings, and perceptions as it is a teaching developed within the sphere of the impermanent phenomenal world. Mm-hmm. So it kind of goes in line with what Moore was talking about. Of course it's fabricated in the sense that it's arising from a concept, but the concept that it's arising from is a concept that is framed by wisdom, whereas suffering arises from a concept based on ignorance. Mm-hmm. And that's a defining difference. And it can seem like we're splitting hairs, but we're really not. The problem with the modern notion, but that was prevalent during the Buddhist time, of nothingness or emptiness, is just that. It substitutes a necessary environment for awakening and so it's no longer available to us. That environment, I mean, is the impermanent environment. Impermanence is not a bad thing, and it's not a good thing. Except it's good in the sense that it allows us to change. It allows us to find a way to change our thinking. And because of impermanence, because of the ability inherent in this environment to change, we can change. The difficulty is when our influences, when what we associate with, are continually pointing our minds and conditioning our minds towards further delusion, we don't have a chance. And the Buddha realized that too. So he gave us an eightfold path to provide the opportunity, to provide the chance for awakening. And once that opportunity is in front of us, the Buddha says to grab onto it like our hair is on fire. Why? Because it's the only chance we have to awaken. Let me continue. My words. The intention of the Eightfold Path is that it bring understanding to those under the delusion that their belief in self requires clinging to what is in reality anicca or impermanent. So that question has come up so many times in here, and it's such an important basic question. What happens to me when I develop the Dhamma, when I awaken? It feels like annihilation, doesn't it? And the Buddha's addressing it, or Dhammadina is addressing it in the Dhamma too. It feels like it, but there's nothing there. But the only way you can know that is to have the experience of it. How could you know it? How many times have people, when you were really worried about something, and somebody said, "Dad, don't worry about it, don't worry about it," did your worry immediately go away? Probably increase. Saying "don't worry about it" is no way to bring that. But saying that I have had the experience of awakening, and this is how you can do the same, and by the way, it's basically painless, then we can do it, can't we? And there's no reason not to. We're not doing this on our own. We're not doing it in a void. We're not doing any of it on faith. We're not doing it because the Savior said, "Do it, and you'll be good to go forever and ever." He's saying, "Do this now, and you'll have a human life, no matter how long it is, of lasting peace and happiness." It's a pretty good deal. Vasaka then inquires if the virtues, if the qualities of virtue, concentration, and wisdom are developed through the Eightfold Path, or do these qualities inspire the Eightfold Path? What an interesting question, isn't it? Vasaka, the Eightfold Path, is inspired by the qualities of virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood inspire the development of heightened virtue. Meaning it points us in the right direction. Now that Dhammadina and the Buddha are describing the synergistic and holistic nature of the Eightfold Path.
The effects of being on the path.
Yes. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation inspire the development of heightened concentration. And right view and right intention inspire the development of heightened wisdom. The Vasaka then asks, what is concentration and what is the framework for right concentration? What are the requisites and how is concentration developed? Samadhi, or non-distraction, is concentration. The framework for right concentration is the four foundations of mindfulness: being mindful of the breath in the body, being mindful of feelings arising and fading away, being mindful of thoughts occurring and fading away, and being mindful of the present quality of mind. Right effort provides the requisites for right concentration. You should always endeavor with skillful desire and persistence for the non-arising of unskillful qualities and to abandon unskillful qualities that have yet arisen. You got all that? It just simply means to continue your right efforts within the framework of the Eightfold Path, to be mindful of the unskillful and skillful aspects of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Everybody's got that? Again, the simple framework of the Eightfold Path is what delivers us to awakening.
That I get.
Yeah, a lot easier than the words that were used there. And Vasaka always endeavor with great desire and persistence to generate skillful qualities that have yet arisen and to maintain skillful qualities that have arisen. What does that mean, Helen?
If you've got it, go with it. And what you don't have, work on it.
Beautiful. That's it. I'm gonna change this article and put those in. Thank you. Dhammadina, what are fabrications? Vasaka, there are the three fabrications. There's bodily fabrications, verbal fabrications, and mental fabrications. In and out breaths are bodily fabrications, as breaths are generated from the clinging aggregate of form. Isn't that interesting? So the Dhammadina is not teaching that there's anything right or wrong here in any of these, just that this is all arising within the three marks of existence. All of these concepts and all of this direction is practically applied to where we are in the moment. Does everybody see that? There's nothing mystical about what's being taught here, either by Dhammadina or the Buddha or by yours truly. It's simply how to develop the Dhamma. Notice, remember how Vasaka started this. What is I making? How do I bring it to cessation? How do I notice it? How do I bring it to cessation? In and out breaths are bodily fabrications, as breaths are generated from the clinging aggregate of form. Feelings and perceptions are mental fabrications, as they are generated by the clinging aggregates of feelings and perceptions. Condition and discursive thought and evaluation are verbal fabrications, as they are generated from the clinging aggregate of consciousness. So it's getting a little bit subtle here, but do you see how the Dhammadina is describing the creative nature of the five clinging aggregates to create experiences that are rooted in ignorance and prone to suffering? And the reason why I'm using those words is because they are created in this sense, they are fabricated. We are creating something out of a pile of clay that's going bad. So even though we might be able to mold it and shape it and polish it and put maybe some chia seeds and grow hair on it, it's still moldy clay, no matter how good we make it look, no matter how we dress it up and paint it or whatever you do to clay. There's nothing we can do. What's that? You can't put a purse on a saddle, whatever that thing is.
Lipstick on a pig.
Yes. And so, because the pig is ignorant, it can never be not ignorant, unless it finds a way to recognize and abandon its own ignorance. See you, Christine. See you, Keila. See you, Joe. Conditioned and discursive thought and evaluation are verbal fabrications as they are generated from the clinging aggregate of consciousness. How then does the attainment of cessation of feelings and perceptions develop? Dhammadina says, a well-informed person who has developed understanding through the Eightfold Path does not have a thought of attainment or clinging. Rather, their refined mind leads to the cessation of feelings and perceptions. Verbal fabrications simply cease, then bodily fabrications, and finally mental fabrications. Again, there's nothing else to do except to develop the Eightfold Path. And as a natural consequence of developing and integrating the Eightfold Path, the problem of fabrication simply falls away.
What was the sequence that she says? What sequence?
Verbal, bodily, and then mentally. And if you think about that, in relation to the Eightfold Path, it's usually right speech that we start recognizing where we're acting in an unskillful way. So it kind of makes sense that we would recognize fabrications in just the same way, and that it would be more difficult to recognize, I mean, not meaning impossible, but more difficult to recognize a bodily fabrication as a verbal fabrication, and more difficult even then to recognize a mental fabrication over the other two. But not to say that they're all different, and not to say that it's all that important, except to recognize that they're fabrications. Right? Okay. How does the attainment of cessation of feelings and perceptions develop? A well-informed person who has developed understanding through the Eightfold Path does not, does not have a thought of attainment. Rather, their refined mind leads to the cessation of feelings and perceptions. Verbal fabrications cease, then bodily fabrications, and finally mental fabrications. Dhammadina continues, when a well-informed person emerges from the cessation of feelings and perceptions, they are empty of clinging, meaning empty of, most important type of emptiness is empty of clinging to wrong views. That's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma, is to empty ourselves of clinging. That's the proper use of emptiness as a concept. Am I empty of ignorance, or is there a shred of ignorance left? The Buddha wouldn't use such a powerful term as emptiness if it wasn't singularly important. Dhammadina continues, when a well-informed person emerges from the cessation of feelings and perceptions, they are empty of clinging, free of self-identification and conditioned mind. Free of it. So again, the Buddha wouldn't be, Dhammadina would be teaching something that is just conceptual, or that the goal is something that is just conceptual. We are free of conditioned mind. Imagine that. And again, directly through the Eightfold Path. The well-informed person's mind inclines towards seclusion and away from delight and entanglement with the world. We naturally start developing a more quiet and a peaceful mind. We're naturally less entangled in the world. In fact, it's a good way of just judging whether you're integrating the Dhamma. Do you seem as far as busy as you always were? Because a natural consequence of developing the Dhamma is starting to recognize and diminishing our unnecessary entanglements with the world, and naturally desiring a quieter, more peaceful life. And that's something that just occurs. But it's also important to recognize, if you feel like you're always running around, it's probably something to look at, because you're probably running around too much. But use the Dhamma to recognize that, and in a non-judgmental way, look at the things that you can let go of, that you don't need to be constantly engaging, constantly using to create the distraction and keeping your own deluded mind going. The Buddha then asks, how many kinds of feelings are there? There are only three types of feelings, Visakha. There is a pleasant feeling, painful feelings, and neutral feelings. And if you look at that, that's all that we can have. And it's really in the neutral feelings, when there's nothing that has our attention, that we stay most distracted, when there's nothing that's exciting us.
I'm sorry, John.
Yes.
In the neutral feelings, you stay most distracted.
Yes, because there's nothing there. A neutral feeling is just a feeling that has... that.
It's not calm?
It's not necessarily calm, but it's a distraction of this moment. So a good example might be reading a really exciting novel. So my mind wouldn't be calm while I'm reading that novel. And the distraction would be the novel. I'm not saying we should never read a novel, but the distraction would be the act of reading in this moment. My mind is not well concentrated. It's caught up in this novel. That's not a well-focused mind, is it? So again, maybe I'm using a bit of a metaphor that I shouldn't touch on, but that's really the point. Do you have more, Lorna?
In a calm state, you're not distracted, surely.
That's right.
The opposite of what you said. You said when your mind is calm, that's when you're most distracted.
No.
No, when your mind is neutral. Yeah. When your mind is neutral. So a mind that's neutral, let me think of another. It might be something that is cleaning the house while the radio is playing. That mind is not calm.
No.
Probably not.
Again,
we're playing with words. If that person is awakened, they could have the music and the TV and the kids screaming and the dog barking and their mind is calm. A normal, unawakened person, a neutral quality of mind is still a mind that is distracted. And usually it's a developed neutrality. In other words, we've got the radio playing while I'm vacuuming the floor. I need that constant distraction.
So you've tuned out to what's actually happened.
Well, I might be...
good and the bad.
If I vacuum the floor without the music playing, it might remind me that I'm vacuuming the floor and how much I hate doing this, and my mind is now agitated. But I found a way to distract myself from what I'm doing by turning the radio on and allowing myself not to feel what I'm feeling. So my feelings are neutral. I can't identify the feeling right now as agitated. But in that agitation, my mind isn't calm, is it? It's just distracted.
So
thanks for bringing it up, and that's the point that I'm making. Just because our minds are neutral doesn't mean that we've developed anything. In fact, hold on 1 second, please, everyone. Then I'll go in our room. One of the problems with what has developed in modern spirituality and certainly modern Buddhism is we've created many strategies to bring our minds to a state of neutrality and calling it calm. I have a guy who's still friends of mine, and he used to be... I've got to be careful before I go with this. I'm going to change the subject because I don't want to go down that road. It's often that we're able to develop strategies that distract our minds in a seemingly wholesome way that we say, well, there, it's calm. And that's Dhamma practice. That's not. It's just a neutral quality that we've developed that is now such a very powerful strategy to even overcome. So one of the things that I've been told and I've heard and been a part of is this idea of constant prostrations as leading to awakening. And one school that I actually took my vows in is that you do 108,000 prostrations. That's a full prostration. From a standing position, you kneel, lay down, touch your head, come up. That's one. You do 108,000 of those, and then you can begin your Dhamma practice. I'm not putting it down. That's something that is taught today, and it was never taught by the Buddha. But that's a substitute, and it creates a year's-long experience of neutrality, doesn't it? I'm just doing this. And I've had people say that doing that is very meditative and deepens concentration. It certainly may well be. I don't know that it's going to deepen concentration, but it will certainly distract from what's occurring if I'm focused on doing this, aren't I? But it's not a substitute for sitting practice. It's just developing, it's using something to create neutral feelings.
Is chanting the same thing?
And I'm going to always get myself in trouble when I say this, but yes. Most of its applications. Because if you look at, and I'm someone who spent many years involved in a place that did a lot of chanting, and I chanted. So I'm talking from firsthand experience. The chanting is used in a few ways and taught to use it this way, that the chanting itself has certain vibrations, the words themselves, and I know you all know this, and the vibrations have a physical and emotional and spiritual effect on us and start tuning our minds in a certain way. That may all be true. Again, it's not the reason why the Buddha taught meditation or mindfulness. Again, may or may not be true, but it's not useful as far as deepening concentration. Because if you think about that, using meditation for any other reason, except to deepen concentration, can often allow me to substitute something that will create neutrality in meditation rather than concentration. So again, that's why the Buddha didn't teach those other things. He taught meditation for one specific reason. There was questions and comments. Bonnie?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was thinking about that neutrality piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so accustomed to either being excited about something that could be good or creating drama about something that is just all made up. And I think in that state of neutrality, we're probably more likely to find a distraction because we're used to being here or being here in the drama.
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely true. Thank you for saying that. That in this way, and in this description, remember everything that I'm talking about, that we're talking about, the Buddha's talking about, is taught in the proper context. You know, there's some usefulnesses to neutrality. Usefulness to neutrality. In this sense, being neutral is still being stuck in a mind rooted in delusion. So the experiences within that experience are just going to contribute to delusion. Tom?
I just want to make sure I'm kind of getting it. Neutrality. Did you say?
Say it this way. Neutral feelings.
Neutral feelings. So, to give an example about vacuuming, don't like vacuuming, I play music to take my distraction from the vacuum. So is it kind of using a positive to offset a negative, and that's how you end up neutral.
That's a good question. Thank you, Tom. Again, I can see where you go there. I'm not using neutrality in that way as a middle way between unpleasant experiences, but I can see how you get there. It's just describing a feeling that is neither agitated or calm. It's just a neutral feeling. And if you look at your life, most of your life is experienced from that place of ambivalence. We don't really care too much about what's going on.
If I get into intellectual pursuits,
that leads to this because what that then leads to. We're getting into something that is pretty deep, and I'm not sure we can even go there, but I'm going to ask that question again.
Well, would intellectual pursuits
in
that neutral plane?
This is where,
for that reason?
Yes. That's exactly it. So we often use our own thinking process as a place of neutral distraction, meaning I just keep this story going on in my head, and I'm constantly distracted. And it doesn't bother me. It doesn't do much for me. But that's what we're coming up against when we first sit down in meditation, is that intellectual need to have every thought that occurs to me be a self-referential thought. And so even that those thoughts that are seemingly neutral because they're not causing an observable reaction have an underlying stress-inducing character about them. And medical science has proven that in the last 20 years, hasn't it? So it's not just that we're always feeling good, that we should be striving for. And in fact, it's not for any permanent state because that's impossible. What we should recognize is the cause of our own stress or distress, which is a lack of understanding. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so again, getting back to where we got a little bit off sidetracked, is that the basic underlying feeling that arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths is ambivalence. I just don't care. And then we create identities over things that give rise and justification to emotion and feeling. Is that clear? But all of those are coming from a wrong view, a misunderstanding of self. And so when we start relying on these feelings and emotions to describe the quality of our life, we're already in trouble, aren't we? And then those feelings and those thoughts are only going to continue delusion. I'm going to keep going with this. Did I end up confusing people more with that?
Yes.
Okay, so let me see if I can bring
John,
you back from it.
What I was trying to say about tune out is it's the same kind of thing. You're just substituting another experience to tune out from the actual experience that is happening. So neutral, tune out, ambivalence, that's what I meant. So I can't just be with vacuuming. I have to give myself something to distract myself. I can't just be with sitting quiet. I have to think about how to solve world hunger or something, you know.
Or anything, anything. You know, the multitasking has become its own kind of modern religion. The more we can multitask, you know, the whole point of that neutral feelings is just that most of our feelings are neutral. They're not good or not bad. We're not craving after anything, and we're not trying to avoid anything. But we're stuck in that stew of ambivalence because there's nothing exciting me in this moment. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
This thing called me needs constant stimulation, and when it's not, it feels stress in some form. So it's not enough for me just to be vacuuming the floor. I got to have the music blasting at the same time to distract me from this unpleasant. Somewhere along the line, I've decided that for some reason, I should never have to vacuum the floor, whatever that might be. I'm too good. It's just too boring. Whatever it might be.
Never go shopping on a Saturday, John.
So I then, from that point of view, from that quality of mind, that this behavior is unacceptable to me, I need to now bring in another behavior, listening to the music, or it might be TV, it might be anything. It might be constantly on the phone while I'm talking to people. We all create strategies to ignore our own ambivalence to life, too. Again, not to make too much about it, I mean to, but that is one of the three feelings that the Buddha talks about. Pleasant feelings that change become painful. Notice the impermanence in this. Painful feelings that change become pleasant. But it's the same underlying identification, is it? With something that I'm judging in some way. Painful feelings that change become pleasant. Neutral feelings may change as well. And here's where we get in trouble, and Bonnie brought this up. That neutral, distracted feeling could become a very painful feeling, depending on what the next moment brings. Or lead to some type of distraction. Neutral feelings may change as well to either pleasure or pain. All feelings are subject to impermanence. Pleasant feelings can give rise to passion obsession, meaning something makes me feel good. Passion obsession is just the phrase saying, this feels good, I need more of it. One piece of chocolate cake isn't enough, I need the whole cake. Neutral feelings can give rise to ignorance obsession. Isn't that interesting? We become obsessed with our own ignorance because it's worked so well. I felt so good in this neutral feeling, I got to cultivate more of it. I got to cultivate my own ignorance. And that is where that the next piece of chocolate cake and the next piece and the next piece or the next chapter or the next drink or the next phone call. It's keeping that neutral, ambivalent feeling first and foremost and allowing me to continue to ignore what's occurring in the moment. Is that clear? Yes, Nash.
It seems like the nuance is that it's not always an agitated mind or an obvious feeling that is taking you outside the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's something much more subtle.
Yes.
That's a numbing factor in your life that's not concentration. And that's not the Eightfold Path, but it's very subtle because it's neutral.
Yep, it's just another form, another strategy that we create to ignore our own ignorance. It's exactly the same thing, and that's why it's so important to recognize this aspect of eye making in this way. Just because, the behavior I'm engaged in right now doesn't have any immediately hurtful consequences or maybe even any obvious long-range current consequences, and it certainly doesn't seem to be hurting anybody else around me, and I'm doing good, might as well continue. So why wouldn't I want to continue? Because it might fall out of the framework of the Eightfold Path. I did that for many, many years with cheap vodka. You know? I just couldn't get enough of it because it maintained a neutral feeling, even though that feeling really wasn't neutral, was it? And again, I'm using an extreme example. We do that with all kinds of things. And I think maybe now you're all understanding that it's the much more subtle things that we use to maintain neutrality in our lives that are more pervasive. Pardon me?
How we like our car or things that give us comfort or I can't have this loud wallpaper. I need these kinds of things. Like,
yes.
It seems like all those things that create, well, you, I guess as you put them all together, you can certainly see how you're creating identity about them, but in smaller, subtler ways.
You can't, that's right. And that's the point. Because a distracted mind can't see the whole picture. It doesn't see all the subtle ways that it's eye-making.
Yeah.
It's constantly distracted from it, even when it's stuck in an experience that feels neutral. So, and the point of that is not to be picking apart every neutral experience you have, it's to recognize how subtle it can be to create a neutral experience and substitute that neutral experience for actual Dhamma experience, meaning pointing my mind towards awakening. Simply because it's not affecting me negatively doesn't mean that it's a useful aspect of Dhamma practice. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. I heard a quote. Can I just say
wait, Helen had your hand up, did you?
I did not, no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have a question, but it isn't formulated yet, okay. So it's just spilling around.
But I heard it, and it just speaks to exactly what we're saying, and I won't quote it right, but it was something like we're all like the ignorance is just going from one latte to one Blockbuster to one da ta da to one da ta da, you know. And then like I hear that all the time, like, oh, you're just going from one latte to one cool glass of water to one, you know. I mean, I
yeah.
You know what Mary
like
said.
Well, that familiarity is part of that too.
Yeah, you know, and just constant. I mean, I unfortunately have, like, could write a whole book on, you know, the world of creating comfort, and John knows that, you know. Like, I can't do anything without something to distract myself. I'm getting better, you know, definitely, but, like, I can just really relate to, like, what is going to make me comfortable in the car, and what is going to today, you know. So it's a very subtle thing, so excuse me. But.
Thank you. Let me just go back a little bit. I'm going to read a little bit now. So we can... Pleasant feelings can give rise to passion obsession, meaning we just create an obsession of what's making me feel good. Painful feelings can give rise to resistance obsession, meaning I'm now creating an aversion to things that are occurring in the world.
Mm.
Frank, you got to go?
I'm leaving.
Ah, it's good to see you. Have a good night.
See you, everybody.
Say hello to everyone. Thank you. Neutral feelings can give rise to ignorance obsession. Again, we become obsessed with our own ignorance, and that really is the nature of anatta. It's obsessed with its own ignorance. When a well-informed person is withdrawn from the obsession of sensual fulfillment and withdrawn from unskillful qualities through meditative absorption, meaning through a well-concentrated mind, they abandon passion and passion obsession. Yearning for final liberation, resistance obsession is abandoned. Meaning we're no longer averse to things that used to drive us crazy. They just come into our lives and flow out of our lives. Why? Because we understand the impermanent nature of them. Deepening meditative absorption, meaning deepening concentration, ignorance obsession is abandoned. Directly through deepening our concentration, we end our own ignorance, or the obsession with maintaining it anyway. Why? Because it takes a tremendous amount of effort to maintain a distracted mind, but we're so distracted and familiar with it, we don't realize it. That's stress. Constant eye-making. Dear lady, what then lies on the other side of ignorance? Dhammadina answers, clear knowing and true insight lies on the other side of ignorance. And Visakha, with clear knowing comes release from clinging to wrong views. From release from clinging comes complete unbinding. You remember how the Buddha described an awakened human being's quality of mind as release or unbound. The quality of that mind is calm. That is how the Buddha consistently described an awakened human being. No mystical or magical terms, no qualities of mind that are unachievable or understandable. Unbound, release. But think about that for a moment. Think about just having a mind that is released from clinging for just a few moments. Well, you've all had that experience in your meditation. And some of you have had it last for a good long time. And some of you will have it last for the rest of your lives. That's an awakened human being. In fact, I would say, as long as you keep coming to class, No, again, the Buddha taught a Dhamma for human beings to awaken in this lifetime, and then maybe I should say today if they want. But you got to really want it. It's possible. But we have to put aside all the things that we have decided are necessary for our happiness, because none of them are. We have everything we need for our happiness all the time. We just have to let go of the views that say it's not occurring right now. Because it can only happen now, right? How else can it happen? Remember what we talked about, maybe it was Thursday night, about the misunderstanding of the power of now and creating this new kind of worship about this, the power of now, the present moment. There's no such thing. The human mind is not capable of comprehending the moment that it's in. But what it can comprehend with the proper mindfulness is the moment that it's in as our life unfolds. In other words, when we're in the continuum of our life, moment by moment unfolding. And that's where true mindfulness comes. To be able to have that type of refined mindfulness of what's occurring in this moment, framed by the Eightfold Path. Just a little bit further. I want to get to the end of this. So, of course, Visakha has another question. Notice he can't just accept the initial teachings of Dhammadina as the whole practice and go and practice and be happy. He keeps wanting answers to what Dhammadina is using to describe a quality of an awakened mind. Dhammadina, what then lies on the other side of unbinding? Visakha, your clinging mind has demanded too many answers. Once in a while it happens even in this room, but... Visakha, your clinging mind has demanded too many answers, and your question will lead to only more confusion and suffering. Again, think about that. Dhammadina has explained to Visakha the Eightfold Path. Visakha has heard the Buddha's teaching on developing the Eightfold Path, and yet it's still not enough. His clinging mind wants to know what's beyond awakening in order for his clinging mind to be willing to even walk that path, because it wants to know, how am I going to establish myself after I'm no longer established? It's a really scary thought for Anatta. Visakha, your clinging mind has demanded too many answers, and your question will lead to only more confusion and suffering. The Buddha's path, the Eightfold Path, culminates in unbinding. Is this not enough? If you wish, go to the Buddha and ask him. Let his answer be enough. I guess Dhammadina remembers some other times, since he's had enough with old Visakha. Get out of here. Go talk to the Buddha.
It would have been great to be a fly on the wall on that conversation.
But Visakha was delighted in Dhammadina's teachings. He bowed to her and left for the Buddha. Finding the Buddha nearby, he sat down to one side of the Buddha and recounted what Dhammadina told him. The Buddha replied, Dhammadina is very wise and of great discernment. I would have answered your questions exactly as she has. This is how you should remember those teachings. So Dhammadina knew what she was teaching. She knew the importance of pointing Dhammadina back to the Eightfold Path to answer these questions that he was coming up with. And also getting into the slightly more subtle aspects that Dhammadina probably had, or Visakha probably hadn't considered yet. So notice now that as you have developed the Eightfold Path, start integrating that into your understanding of the impermanence of all things. And start looking at the aspects of your life that you're ambivalent about, and see if you can notice any subtle eye-making even there. Okay, that's my talk for tonight. Let's go around the room, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. We have a big class, so please feel free to talk, but be mindful of how long you're talking. Isabel, good to see you.
Good to see you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'll see you, Andrew. Say hello to Judy.
Oh, yes.
See you, Scott. See you, Margaret.
See you, guys.
It was. More to come.
Yeah. I mean, some of it, I'm not going to lie, I was getting a little, like feeling some dukkha, like feeling more stress, just because I think I'm just kind of been in a place of being aware of my ignorance and my suffering.
when we start to become aware of the nature of our suffering, it can be pretty disconcerting. And, you know, feel like we're Because we're not supposed to be okay with that. You know, when we have a thought that's upsetting, we're supposed to find out why and where it's coming from and end it immediately and do something and all that, instead of just being with it.
Yeah.
So it kind of can throw your equilibrium aside.
Yeah.
And all we can do is just keep doing what we're doing. I'm glad you're here tonight. Don, good to see you.
Yeah, I find some of the talk tonight a little confusing.
Like what?
Excuse me?
Like what?
I don't know in particular. Maybe I'm just feeling tired.
Okay, yeah. I think
generally speaking, listening to everything, I mean, when I'm feeling that distraction, and I tend to feel lots of distraction lately, when I go back to impermanence, like when I go back to really focusing and thinking about impermanence and concentrating and developing more of an understanding of this universe in flux and that type of awareness, you know, holding that in mind, I that brings me a lot of relief. That's a very general thing to say, but I think that's been helpful.
It makes sense, Don. I mean, understanding impermanence brings relief.
Hmm.
You know, and even at a fairly surface level, when first starting out, it brings relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it simply does. Understanding the true nature of the world. So I'm glad you're here. Mark, good to see you.
Good to be here. I think I'll pass. I think I said more than my fair share, as usual.
Thank you. Be careful getting up. You don't bang your head on that.
Thank you.
Nash, good to see you.
I thoroughly enjoyed the talk. It was a few words new. Obsession, resistance.
Nope.
Ignorance resistance.
Nope.
Come on, help me.
Take care, Jessica. Good to see you.
What kind of, what was it? Something resistance. Come on.
What? I don't know where you're...
It was a term. It was a new term.
Well, they weren't... Resistance obsession was not
resistance
some...
Resistance obsession.
That's not... it's not new in the sense that I've never said it before. I've read that...
Right. Use clean.
Well, I've read this article quite a few times, and that's where those words came from. But
okay, so that's fine. Then I have nothing to say.
No, you.
I have nothing to say.
I'm curious about where you're going with that.
I don't recall the end of. I've heard Dhammadina's teachings to Vasakha, and I never heard the end of it.
Oh,
so
okay.
That was new for me tonight.
Yeah, that's an important part.
Session.
Yeah, and she's just
that's
thank
a,
you.
That's yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, and she's just describing the nature of mind rooted in ignorance. It's compulsive.
Just that term. This is an interesting little term.
Thank you. Nash, good to see you.
Good to see you. Just really quickly, even though it wasn't mentioned specifically in the sutta, like pretty much everything in the sutta reminded me of something that I heard you say early on about how the Buddha would answer certain questions, where you would say, the question itself is the source of your suffering.
Yep.
And just like hearing the Sakha ask question after question after question, instead of just simply taking it. Mm-hmm. And other things in the sutta really made that statement really profound to me. And I just found it interesting how that wasn't specifically brought up, but that's what I got from the sutta in a way.
Yeah. Thank you. That's so important to see that. And let me keep going. It's gotten late. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to be here. I'm going to chew on that neutral feelings thing.
Good.
There's a lot in it that
there is.
I've heard it a few times, and it never struck me as how insidious it is.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you said that. And understand there's a big difference between neutral or ambivalence and a peaceful and calm mind.
Mm.
Tom, good to see you.
Hey. I'm not sure I really got it. Would you mind starting over?
Sure. So this is the week 8 class.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions about your meditation practice or what you've done there?
Oh, probably lots. so since we don't have a lot of time.
Okay, well,
I'm very happy that we came here today.
I am too. I'm glad that you and Toby came. You know, on the website, there's this meditation in recorded form. You can listen to it. And then it really is just a matter of hopefully coming to our classes and learning more about the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're here tonight. David, good to see you.
I'll pass.
I'm glad you're here. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. And I love it when we start getting into the nuances, you know. It's always another reminder that just when you think you've got things, there's more work to be done.
Yeah.
Taking you on the path, you know, it's a great class. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. I guess I'm more confused now about what greater concentration means. Because I would think that the ability to sit down with a book and be there with the book is concentration. You're not anywhere else, but you're there.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't know what concentration means.
Oh, I think you're right. I think that was a poor metaphor that I used about reading a book could be, but it could. I mean, it just wasn't a good use of a metaphor. Concentration can be increased. And that's what meditation does. And so beyond that, concentration is just another word would be samadhi, a non-distracted mind. So it's a mind that is able to stay focused on whatever it's doing, including reading a book. But the metaphor I was using was that book could have you thinking about all kinds of other things rather than what you're actually reading. And that is a kind of a way of describing neutral distraction. Does that help?
Well, when you read a book, Helen, you're very concentrated on it. You're with the book. You're not reading it to distract you from other things. Or you're not pretending to read it while you're off going off in some fantasy about the... Well, maybe you are. I don't know.
Well,
I'll
go back to the metaphor just to help explain it. When I was younger, I used to read a lot of science fiction. I love science fiction, especially Robert Heinlein. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading those stories, I was no longer reading them. I was there, you know, wherever he had us flying around. And so I literally wasn't present with the words at times. I was in my imagination, driven by the words.
But that's the intent of the author.
Yeah. I know, but it wasn't wrong. Maybe that's where the problem. I'm not saying that it's wrong to do that. It's not right or wrong. I'm just using it to describe a neutral state where we're distracted, or could be.
But is it possible to be? I guess I'm having a hard time seeing how that can be framed in like wrong view. In wanting to read a book and doing that, because I love reading.
Well, yeah, boy, I use the wrong metaphor.
Yeah.
I think we first need to get past seeing it as good or bad or right or wrong.
Okay.
Because that's not really what I meant. It's either skillful or it's unskillful,
right,
in relation to the Dhamma. So there's nothing wrong with reading, nothing wrong with reading good books, nothing wrong with reading trashy books for that matter, if that's what you want to do. Understand that the act of reading, no matter how great the book is not necessarily Dhamma practice.
Right.
So it could be, even though it's a good book, and it's teaching me something that's useful, it's not necessarily developing a well-concentrated mind. Pardon me?
Unless it's your book.
Unless it's my book. So again, reading is not good or bad. Reading is not neutral or not neutral. Reading, if you're reading my book, can be positive or not. It's the quality of mind that I was attempting to describe in that metaphor, not relating to that reading is somehow not skillful to do.
Like an ignorant mind would be distracted because they don't have like the context of.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, we can read. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Like anything else, we can misuse whatever we're doing, including how we read a book. You know, I mean, it's just really jumped down a hole here. Just the fact of reading doesn't necessarily. You could take it by saying reading a book does not lead to concentration. You can take that even further by saying reading doesn't increase concentration. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that framing things within the framework of the Eightfold Path develops awakening. As an aspect of life, many, many things we're ambivalent to. We simply don't notice it because they're more routine. And reading a book might be one of them. So reading a book isn't good or bad. Vacuuming the floor isn't good or bad. Listening to music while you're vacuuming the floor while you're reading a book isn't good or bad. It's simply a big distraction. That's the point. Or it can be. Now, I guess there's some people that are awakened that can vacuum the floor, listen to the music, read a book, watch TV, and eat a sandwich at the same time. I would think you're pretty distracted if you do that.
I think the quality of my mind after reading a book is different than it is after watching, say, TV before going to bed.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. There's no doubt about that.
So that's a quality of mind that I can relate to. And I think, you know, speaking of nuance, focus, concentration, what's the difference?
I don't mean to interrupt you. Yeah. Your question is important. I'm going to put a stop right now to picking apart words.
Yeah.
Because we're really going too far.
Yeah.
Focus, concentration, you know, it really is all part of the same thing. What is important is to develop the Eightfold Path as a pathwork to awakening and understand when we're adding to that or taking away from that. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Lorna, good to see you. I'm sorry, Helen, did I answer your question or help bring some clarity to concentration? Lorna?
I think I understand what you're talking about. I haven't thought about it within the Dharma as much as we have tonight, so it's been very good for me to visit that. But I would ask you to just bear in mind this class, and we've all sort of picked up on this subject, so if you could, after they finish with the Eightfold Path, maybe we could revisit it on another night.
The Dhamma Dina Sutta? The Kulabhadala Sutta?
The blandness that we go...
the ambivalence and neutral.
Yes, the ambivalence.
All right. I will be, and there's going to be two more classes on this week, and I don't know how far I'm going to get into that, but I might. But also, we'll be getting into it, a little bit deeper in the next few weeks, too, about this. So we'll see more how, just to use the word now, ambivalence fits into dependent origination, and it's part of ignorance. And so we'll probably talk about this next week, and if I don't, please bring it up, that it's an aspect of ignorance is ambivalence. In fact, I would say that ambivalence, ignorance requires ambivalence. Mm-hmm. Another word for that, again, is to ignore. Mm-hmm. So pick your word. So we're really getting into it, and that's what the next few classes are going to be. And as a Sangha, I think we've really developed enough that we kind of understand what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because this is something I've been waiting a little while to introduce, this idea of neutrality and ambivalence, even though I know you've heard me mention it over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. But it is that now we're really getting into the subtleties of eye making. Mm-hmm. And as a Sangha, we don't have a lot of desire for ambivalence in this.
Mm-hmm.
We're willing to go where no man has or woman has gone before. I mean, this is really getting into some pretty heady stuff, and we're doing it, so I'm glad you are. Thank you. Toby, good to see you.
Good to see you. Well, the suffering is optional, and
yes,
the only permanent thing is impermanence and change.
That's it. You got it.
Yeah.
You graduated.
Yeah. But I hope you'll join us again.
I think I will. This is a whole... I mean, I'm not totally ignorant of Buddhism, but this is a whole different perspective on things I've already visited, or things,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to say things I've already known, because that sounds, but it's just a different perspective, and I like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do too. There's not a lot in modern Buddhism about the Eightfold Path, what the Buddha actually taught, Four Noble Truths, and even getting into something like the Three Marks of Existence, they're not usually addressed, at least in this way. And all of this, and I'm sure you picked this up, all of this points back to what the Buddha actually awakened to, which is dependent origination. Mm-hmm. And again, not putting anything down, the reason why these teachings point back to that teaching is that I only teach what the Buddha taught. And ignorance is the essence of what the Buddha taught, or at least emptying ourselves of ignorance. So we have to understand where it comes from if we're going to empty ourselves of it. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Working on emptying that ball. Yeah, this was, what? Yeah, it's a lot to think about all around my head.
That's it.
Well,
I don't mean to pick on you. What do you feel about that? The ambivalent part about this.
Oh God, I'm like.
Are you ambivalent? Or do you have some strong feelings?
I'm very ambivalent about a decision. And so it's really synchronistic for me to have this be the topic. No matter what I do to get to the clarity, it's like what confusion. My hair's on fire, but. The idea that using things to distract you from the distraction of what you need to do, I think it's like anything. For me, it's like using the reading. If I'm really distracted, I'm not able to read.
Yes.
I have to really work on so that it's not the concentration of the Dhamma or of the, you know, the Four Noble Truths, but I've known people who the reading is a distraction because that's all they do. Like, or teenagers who I work with, you know, it's all they do. They hide in their room and read. So I think it can, like anything, it's like I see things on a number line, so to speak. So, you know, trying to be in the middle, obviously, is so nice to be there. But sometimes it's too little or it's too much. So. Now, right now, I keep running back and forth around the fulcrum of my head, but I don't know. So, you know, because I also think about these concepts as related to living, but it's really not about that if we're talking about it in relationship to the Dhamma, to understanding, right?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, thank you. Let me hear what Liz has to say. And we'll... Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. I was going to pass too, but then. So my interpretation of the concept of being able to think what you want to think when you want to think it refers back to thinking about where you are in the present moment in relationship to the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if you find yourself in a position of... you know, I was in a state of agitation for most of the day, and I really kept trying to switch it back to where I was in the either the Eightfold Path or the Four Noble Truths, and I just wasn't really getting anywhere with it. And so I think I just have to focus more on the two sits a day, and it will all sort of fall back into place. Yeah. So if you were in a state of agitation, if you're in a state of neutrality, like in between thoughts where you say, oh my God, I'm not doing anything at this moment. I need to look at the news, or I need to pick up my phone, or I need to, you know, whatever. It is that state of distraction and that breaking away from thinking about what you should think when you want to think it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes it's easier to be able to look at reflect on yourself and what your activities are at the moment and say, this is what I need to do next. You know. But then there are other times when the agitation is a little bit overwhelming and, you know, it's not as easy to grasp.
Yeah, it gets pretty subtle. remember that the whole point of this is to awaken, gain full human maturity, develop a mind of lasting peace and calm no matter what's occurring. And so, holding that in mind allows us to be at peace with whatever we're doing in the moment, because we are resting in right view and right intention, meaning we understand that right now, where I am in my life, no matter where I am, if I'm within the framework of the Eightfold Path, I'm inclining myself towards awakening. I'm doing everything I can for myself in this lifetime to develop a life of lasting peace and calm. And along the way, it's important. What the new meditation instructions that we're doing now is helping to put our focus on the arising and passing away of all things, meaning no matter what we're doing in the moment. What Helen brought up is so important. Do you mean that I shouldn't? I'm paraphrasing what you were saying. It's not right to enjoy reading a book. Of course, we should enjoy anything we're doing. And something as intimate and personal as reading, which it really should be if it's written well, is something that we should bring the Dhamma into, not use outside of the Dhamma. In other words, to read with a framework of the Eightfold Path, or holding in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path, and see what we're reading from that point of view, because then we'll really understand it. It'll have more meaning. So getting back to this idea of ambivalence or neutral feelings, as we awaken, as we gain full human maturity, every moment is meaningful. But that doesn't imply that every moment is agitating. It's meaningful because we're present and we understand what's occurring. Period. It's a tough one.
It all has meaning.
Yeah, isn't that what everybody's looking for? How come there's no meaning? You know, I know how many times when I was in the construction business, used to come up often. I shouldn't say it came up a few times. Very, very wealthy people that would, for some reason, confide in me that they have all this and that, but they're so unhappy. You know, we've all heard that. We've heard stories of people that won the lottery and 2 years later they've eaten themselves and drank themselves to death because of that. Why does that occur? It occurs because we don't know how to think. We don't know how to think about our human life. The Buddha recognized that upon his awakening, and he said, wait a minute, you guys got it wrong. That's what anatta means. But then he said, I got a way of living in the world and thinking in the world that brings lasting peace and happiness. And you can do anything you want as long as it's framed by the Eightfold Path. And the ego, the anatta, doesn't want to do that because there's no space for what's not real in the Buddha's awakening. You know, so the views have to be well framed. Okay, that's enough for tonight. We are going to get into the chapter on dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates next week. We'll probably be 2 weeks on that. And we'll get into this a little bit more deeply over the next couple of weeks. And when we get into karma and rebirth, there'll be a little bit more about this ambivalent nature of life, because that lives within karma and rebirth too. So, all right. The big announcement is March the 4th, this coming Sunday. Wait a minute. This coming Saturday.
Sunday.
is the painting party we're having down at Rare Art and Learning Cooperative in Flemington. Starts at 1:00. The address is in the email. I hope you can all come. It'll probably just be for a couple hours. If you can bring a paintbrush or roller and that kind of stuff, or cleaning supplies. Mary Beth has asked us if we would help painting a couple rooms and clean the windows. So.
What time is it, sir?
1:00. So I hope to see you all there if you can make it. Okay, we'll finish like we usually do with metta, and our retreat is May the 17th. Info's on the website, so sign up as soon as you can if you're joining us. And find your relaxed meditative posture, and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And now is the time to meditate. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.